Well, I'm excited as we continue this new series or start this new series of By Faith, because I see a lot of confusion, I think, in the culture, just as far as in the Christian culture. But what do we mean when we say living by faith? And is it all up to me? And is it about me having more faith? Because I don't know if there's a more weighty word or more significant word in the English language than this word of faith. And the scriptures bear this out. I mean, it says in Romans 14:23, everything that does not come from faith is sin. Now, it's interesting. A lot of times we'll talk about confession and we'll talk about maybe a lustful thought or greed or whatever it is. But when's the last time you confessed and just said, you know what, Lord, I just feel like my faith is non-existent or my faith is just not there. I'm not trusting you the way that I can. It's a big deal. You know, I think that we want to become an overcomer. Then the way you do it is by faith. 1 John 5:5 says, this is the victory that has overcome the world, our faith. And so it really isn't a question of whether we have faith or not, because this room is filled with some very faithful people. What we're more concerned about is the direction of our faith. What is your faith placed in? Because let's face it, there's a lot of things in our culture that we can place our faith in, whether it's our academic prowess, our athletic prowess, or maybe, you know, our job, or, you know, our bank account, or spouse, or savings, or, you know, our future, whatever it is. We can put a lot of stock in these things, but ultimately, what we place our faith in, can it really bear the weight of that which we are putting our faith in? And so we're not going to try to convince you in this series to have faith. We're just, because you already have it. We're just trying to make sure that the direction that you take it is in the direction that God intended it for it to be. And secondly, that whatever you're placing your faith in can bear the weight that comes from placing your faith in it. It was A.W. Tozer who said this: faith is not in itself a meritorious act. The merit is in the one toward whom it's directed. So it isn't faith in faith itself. It is who do you have your faith in? And that's what makes all the difference. And I don't think there's a better place to unpack this than Hebrews chapter 11, which is known as the Hall of Faith, that lists faithful after faithful moment with those who are of old. And it's oftentimes called the Hall of Faith. And so I'm going to have it on the screen. We're going to read together basically Hebrews 11 verses 1 through 3 and then verse 6. So if you will read this with me. Now faith is the confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. And without faith, it's impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to Him must believe that He exists, and He rewards those who earnestly seek Him. Thank you. So really, context is everything. And so when you, and many of you are probably familiar with Hebrews chapter 11, but why was it written? And what it was, what was going on at the time was these are first century Jewish believers. They were new converts from Judaism, and they were being heavily persecuted. See today when we look at what's going on in China, in North Korea, in the Middle East, I mean, there's some heavy persecution going on with the church. This is what was happening then, and we know that so because when you look at the verses before it in chapter 10, verse 34, it says this: you suffered along with those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because you knew that you yourselves had a better and lasting possession. So don't throw away your confidence. It will be richly rewarded. And so they weren't coerced into this. They weren't obligated to do this. They joyfully accepted it. Now that's otherworldly. I mean, that is faith that's going on here. And so Hebrews 11 was written to encourage them that they're not alone, that there are others who have gone through unbearable times. And it wasn't the amount of faith they had, but rather it was where they placed their faith that made all the difference. The faith, in other words, is the key. And the challenge, I think, for us who live in a pretty comfortable environment is how do we stoke the fires of faith that these people had in heavy persecution? Because when you are heavily persecuted, it really refines faith. And it emboldens it, actually. So when you're in non-persecuted times like we are, then how do you keep the faith stoked? How do you keep it going? And so this morning, I want to look at just some, how do we define this? And what does faith exactly look like? Nay Bailey, who was one of the founding people with Crew, wrote a book years ago that has kind of been republished. And I think it's a classic. Everyone should read it. It's called Faith is Not a Feeling. Faith is not a feeling. And she defines faith in that book as just taking God at his word. And so she says, you just take God. That's what faith means. Take God at his word. And so if you go through Hebrews 11, she'll take whenever times it says by faith, she would say, by taking God at his word, Abraham did this. By taking God at his word, Enoch did this. And by taking God at his word and went on. And I think this is, I mean, she's accurate on this because Romans 10:17 tells us faith comes from hearing. And hearing through the word of Christ. In other words, as we hear the word of God, faith gets stoked. It gets cultivated. But I think there's more. And I want to press this for more here because in Hebrews 11:6, in the very last part of the verses we were looking at this morning, it says this, and without faith, it's impossible to please God because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. Now, the key word there is earnestly seek. And it means to actually crave, to have a passionate pursuit of something, to have your heart captured by something. I mean, this is why Mark 12:30, it says, love the Lord our God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. Notice it doesn't say, hey, love him, give him a little bit of your heart, give him a little bit of your mind, give him a little bit of your soul. He says, no, go all in. Go all in and give him it all. And I like how A.W. Tozer puts it. He says, faith is the gaze of the soul upon a saving God. Faith is the gaze of the soul upon a saving God. In other words, it's when you are so enraptured with God that is who your total focus is on, who you want to please, and it is the object of your faith. And so let me see if I can use that and the scriptures here this morning to come up with it, what I think is a really good definition that will help us as we go through this morning. So here it is. Faith is this. It's the gaze of the soul upon a God who is worthy of our full confidence and assurance that results in demonstrations of commitment and trust. Faith is the gaze of the soul upon a God who is worthy of our confidence and assurance that results in demonstrations of commitment and trust. In other words, the gaze of the soul part, that's the earnestly seeking. That's our hearts are drawn toward him. Who is worthy of our full confidence of assurance, that's the taking God at his word part. And we take him at his word because he's trustworthy. And the demonstrations and commitments of trust, that's what you see in the rest of Hebrews chapter 11. Because of these things, they are trusting him. And so this morning, I want to unpack that definition and go through the three parts of it. The first one is just the gaze of the soul, earnestly seeking. In other words, and another way to say this is whatever captures your heart. In other words, your faith flows out of whatever your heart is captured by. If you find something in life that you think is just, it has this promise for you, and you put all your eggs in that basket, you'll go after it. Why? Because your heart, you're going after whatever your heart has been captured by. And this can be positive or negative, right? I mean, of all the things that we can put our faith in. And when you look at Hebrews chapter 11, it's interesting that sometimes it can be overwhelming. Because when you read down through it, you go, and by faith they did this, and by faith they did this. And you go, gosh, man, I don't have that kind of faith, and there's no way I could do that. Well, you have to remember, Hebrews 11 is like the highlight reel of faith. I mean, it's not telling everything that went on in the person's life, because it wasn't like these people were always at this level. They were, and they were commended for it, and they had great faith, but there were also moments when they weren't. I mean, look at, like, say, for instance, Moses. Moses murdered somebody. Abraham, he repeatedly lied. You know, Noah, he got wasted and, well, a whole lot else happened, and we'll get to that. You know, but the whole thing is that you can just see where they had moments where it wasn't like they were at the pinnacle and like they were at, and everything was going, a faithful moment. And so I think what this is saying to us is faith is a process. It grows as God in Christ captures more of our heart. And it's not that we get more of him. He gets more of us. And our heart becomes more and more enraptured with him and who he is. And I've seen this repeatedly in my years of ministry, as I've seen this explicitly and implicitly with different people. But I think this always comes to this, and I've seen it. Whatever captures somebody's heart, if it's anything other than Christ, they'll have a hard time displaying faith. And where it really was explicitly, I saw it, was when I was working with crew, and I was at the University of Kentucky. I was in a fraternity, and I led a Bible study, and one of the guys had a poster on his wall of $1 million. He had that poster. And I said, well, why do you have a poster of $1 million? And he goes, that's my goal. I want to get $1 million as fast as I can, and I want to retire as early as I can. And this guy was 19. And he's like, and that was his sole passion. I mean, that's what had captured his heart. And so you can understand then, so when we're going through Bible studies, it was always hard for him to get excited about the things of God and to display faith and to do things that required faith. Why? Because all his faith was in what the poster promised, what the money promised. And that captured his heart. And he was all in on it. And so, in other words, if you show me someone who is in love with Christ and whose heart and soul has been captured by God's love for them, and I'll show you a person of great faith. Because, see, faith flows out of a heart that says, God, you have it all. I mean, you've got my heart. If you try to have faith apart from first having the love of Christ invade your soul, then what will happen is you'll have a train wreck. Or you'll make it all about you. I got to have more faith. I got to just do this. If I just have faith, I can do this. And if something doesn't happen, I just didn't have enough faith. And see, it makes it all about us, doesn't it? And again, it's not about the amount of faith we have or how strong a faith we are. It's about the object of our faith, right? About where it's placed, about where it's pointed, about who we're putting it in. I mean, there's a biblical example of this. In Luke chapter 7, there is a Roman centurion who basically is a non-commissioned officer who has 100 men underneath him. And he has one of his men, a servant, who is really deathly ill. And Jesus is coming to Capernaum, and he hears that he's coming. And so he sends the elders ahead and says, get Jesus to come and heal my servant. And now we already know that his heart was taken by God, because the guy was a very generous man and he helped the Jews out tremendously and different things. So when he sent the elders went to Jesus and they said, basically, Jesus, you got to help this guy because he has helped us so much. I mean, and so they're off a little bit, but there's like, he's helped us so much, he deserves this. Well, when Jesus is on the way, the centurion sends word ahead and says, don't come to my house. You don't come. I'm not worthy for you to even be under my roof. I'm not worthy of it. But all you have to do is say the word and my servant will be healed. Just say the word. You don't even have to be here. That's how much I know what you can do. And Jesus, knowing that this wasn't just a surface, hey, let's see what he can do, but his heart was already captured by him, he said this, basically. It's amazing. He says, I tell you, I have not found such great faith, even in Israel. And it came from a Roman centurion, whose heart would be the last one you'd expect to have great faith, whose heart was just so captured by God that he said, look, you don't even have to be here. You can even do it on your own. So my question this morning is, where's your gaze? As we start the series, you know, on faith, where's your gaze? What are you looking at? What is the object of your affection? What are you giving your life for? Where is your gaze? The second part of that definition is the gaze of the soul upon God, who is worthy of our full confidence and assurance. There's really two words that are used here, both the confidence and what we hope for and the assurance of what we don't see. This word confidence obviously means whatever you're hoping in and placing your confidence in. And all of us, I mean, there's so many things in this life we can hope for, right? And we hope for a good job, or we hope for a spouse, or we hope for success in our athleticism, or hope for children, or hope for happiness. But faith here makes them all subservient to the one who really is our ultimate hope. In fact, when Jesus was comforting his disciples about the looming death and departure in this world, he said this: "Do not let your hearts be troubled. If you believe in God, believe also in me. My Father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, I would have told you that I'm going there to prepare a place for you. If I go and prepare a place for you, I'll come back and I'll take you to be with me." It was the belief in that promise that these readers of this Hebrew letter, that's what made the big difference. This is what drove them to even allow the confiscation of their property and have joy in it. As it says in 10:34, "You suffered along with those in prison and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property." Why? Because you knew there was better and lasting possessions that God had in store for you. That's the ultimate hope. Our ultimate hope is what he's promised us, and that when he's promised us for eternity. And this is why it says in verse 35, "So don't throw away your confidence." Now my question would be, well, what would cause somebody to throw away their confidence? If your confidence is God, what causes you to throw it away? And I think there's probably a numerous amount of things, and it might be different for each one of us, but in each one of us, there is something that where maybe God didn't come through in that way, so I'm not placing my confidence in him anymore. God didn't come through in the timing I liked, so I'm not going to place my confidence in that. Whatever it is, you better believe Satan is proposing, and he's going to continue to bring that before you and go, yeah, well, if God really did this, then this wouldn't have happened. Or it wouldn't have happened according to this time. And I love when I just see different responses that point to that ultimate hope. In fact, I just had one this week, and I've been reminded of it in my mentor, who's been mentoring me for 15 years, Lon Allison, is probably one of the most spiritual guys I know, and he has, he's written many books, he's the world evangelist, he's done more for missions around the world than anybody I would know. And he used to be head of the Billy Graham Center, now he's a Bible teaching at Wheaton Bible Church up in Chicago. So we both are from Montana. He's mentored me. We've gotten together once a year for different things. And he's got cancer. And just this last year, just last October, I went with him. We did one of our bucket lists, and we went up to Lambeau Field and took in a Green Bay Packers game. And we thought, well, we got to be a cheesehead for a moment. So we paused for the picture. But Lon, who probably is only 65, maybe 68, somewhere in that category, has liver cancer. And he's been fighting it for 2 years. Unsuccessfully, he's done everything he can with the most prominent people who can help him. Right now, he is on some experimental thing that they won't know until this week, actually, whether that's really working. But in the process, he's also gotten some spots on his lungs that they think are cancerous as well. So this is not looking good. And just this week, his wife posted on CaringBridge and said this: "As Lon mentioned in his past posts, we won't know what is going on inside his body until his scan next week. However, we both see a decline in his good hours where he is without pain." A couple of phrases have helped me put a name to our experience. The first one being, the freight train of cancer is going down the track to its destination. And the other phrase is, cancer is not mindful of our plans and our calendars. These are sobering thoughts. But I want you to know that God is with us. He truly has sustained us. We know he will continue to do so. Many people have experienced what we are experiencing, and there is great comfort in seeing their strong examples. From the beginning, we realized that joy and sorrow exist together. And he was hoping that he would be able to make it in January when his middle daughter is getting married and he could walk her down the aisle and preach at her wedding and lead them through the vows. But it looks like things are not heading that direction. And so at the very end of the post, she said, "So we've moved the wedding up. We're going to have a small wedding this next weekend so that he can actually do the ceremony and he can walk her down the aisle." But in the midst of it, even in the midst of that, they're saying, you know, if you asked him, he'd say, yes, I want to be here. I want some more years to be able to enjoy my grandchildren, to be able to enjoy my children. But ultimately, I know that the ultimate hope is in what Christ has, and that's what I've preached all these years. and I will not abandon it now. It is the ultimate hope. That's a display of where our ultimate hope is. It's the confidence in things we hope for. And I think all of us have it where we've placed our hope in something else only to find that it disappoints. And sometimes the cancer gets eradicated now, and we rejoice with those. And there's sometimes when it doesn't, and we have sorrow with that. We rejoice with those who rejoice, and we grieve with those who grieve, don't we? But our ultimate confidence and hope is where? And it's moments like this that press into that. Because he's far too young to have this kind of thing going on. But the second part, I think, is an interesting thing when the author says it's the assurance about what we don't see. And that's the nature of faith, isn't it? You can't see it. You can't calculate it. You can't plan it. You can't just go, hey, this is the way it's going to happen. That's the very nature of faith. It's out of our control. Which I think brings to a couple truths about faith. And one of them is that biblical faith is, I don't think it's natural. I don't think it's natural for us to have biblical faith. I mean, because we'd rather have anxiety or fear or depression or all the things that Satan tries to bring in instead of trusting and having faith. Those are the things that will come. I just don't think it's natural. I think faith is an infusion of God where he gives you faith in certain circumstances. I don't think faith is blind either. A lot of people think, well, you just, you know, believing Christianity or believing in God is just a blind leap. And I don't think it's that either, because in 11:3 it says, by faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen is not made out of that which was visible. In other words, look, we have full assurance that God was the creator. He put the world in existence. He spoke it into existence. And we can't see that. But we know and we have faith that he is the one that put it all together. In fact, when you go and you see creation, it points back to me. It says, there's a creator. It shouts it. That's why Romans 1:20 says, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power, his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what was made, so that people are without excuse. And here's the deal. I mean, I can go in the Continental Divide of Montana, and I can look out, and I can look across the landscape and go, whoa, this just screams God. There's a creator behind this, but I can have a friend with me, maybe who isn't a person of faith, at least biblical faith, and they can go, I look out there and I see nothing. I see millions of years of ice age forming and things coming together, and it was all put together, and it was a big bang. And I'm like, one person looks at it and goes, wow, this is a great amount of faith. Another person looks at it and goes, I got nothing. So that's why I think faith, it isn't blind. It's something you can see that points back to it. But I think also it's something that is infused by God. And every day you and I are faced with faith situations, smaller or bigger, depending upon the circumstances and depending on what's going on. But this is something that I think maybe help make sense of this. There's the three A's of faith. And these three A's are this: we acknowledge it, then we accept it, and then we act on it. And we do this all the time. Like, say, for instance, when you came in this morning, you took a step of faith by sitting in the chair. I mean, if I'm looking at this stool and I'm going, okay, I acknowledge the fact that it is there. It looks like it has four legs. It's good. I accept the fact that it looks like it's stable. It's made out of wood. So guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to take a step of faith and I'm going to sit in it. It's going to hold me up. Now, if I'm looking at it and I'm going, okay, I acknowledge it, and it's only got three legs on that one, then I'm thinking, I'm not sitting in it. There's no way. And so on a most simplest form, that's what happens. We do that. But we also do it when we make decisions throughout life. And when you chose your major, you may not think you did it by faith, but you're going, you know what? This is the way I'm wired. This is what I'll do. I'll make this decision. It looks good to me. It's what brings joy to me. So I'll take a step of faith and I'll go for it. When I asked Susan to marry me. I mean, it was a process. I think faith is a process. And so first it was like, hey, this is a person I think I would like to get to know. And so I got to know her. And then that was the acknowledgement part. Then there was the acceptance part where we got to know each other. And I thought, boy, my heart is really being drawn towards her and her towards me. So I said, I think I want to marry her, you know. And so then that was the acceptance part. But it wasn't until I went down and said, I do, that I took a step of faith. Now, did I know everything? Did I know the whole future? Did I know everything was going to go on? No, but I knew that I was going to take a step of faith. As a church, we've done that. I mean, we've taken a step. We acknowledge the fact that, hey, we need some more space. We're crammed. This thing, you know, this building is dilapidated, and there's a lot of problems that we have with it all the time. God brings along and brings us a huge building that is just enormous. Across from Harding, and we look and we go, well, that thing's huge, and we went through the process, and we even looked at other facilities, and God kept closing doors and said, but this one's open, and we're like, that one is so big, you know. And I'll say this: when you start to move out in faith, you better understand you're going to get resistance, because when you move in faith, it's not natural, so you'll get resistance, and people will go, oh, there's no way you can do that. There's no way that's going to happen. There's no way this can be it. And so we acknowledge the fact that it was there. We moved forward and God provided each way. And then we accepted it and we go, okay, I think it's time to move forward. And God gave it to us at a great price. We paid cash for it. Now we got it. And we acted upon it. We took a step of faith. Now, you know, and this is the way that I think all of us do this. Now that we got it, I'm like, whew, okay, Lord, we got it. Now, just give us all the money right away. And he goes, and this is what I get back. I'm like, what would make you think that now that you've by faith got to this point, I'm all of a sudden going to lay it all out so you can see it and you no longer have to live by faith? You're going to have to trust me every step and at the next step and with the next step and keep taking steps. And as you keep taking steps, what you're going to do is your faith in me will increase. I was talking with a builder the other day, and he says, you know, Doug, why don't we just go do this, and we'll do this and this and this. And I said, well, the difference is the goal for us is not just to get the building done. The goal for us is to increase the faith of the people. And if we went that route, build faith. That's just going to get a building built. But it's never been about the building. It's about the building as a result of us having faith and trusting God with something that we go, I have no idea how that's going to happen. And you know how we try to avoid situations like that, don't we? I mean, we don't like to be in situations where we're walking out on the edge and going, oh. You know, when God was taking the Jewish people into the Promised Land and they had to cross the Jordan, you know, I can just imagine the conversations that we're having about a quarter mile from the Jordan, and they're seeing this thing at flood stage, and I can just imagine them going, it's impossible. It ain't gonna happen. Lord, if you could lower the water first, then we could take a step. And what did he make them do? Step in at flood stage. And I bet it wasn't until their heel hit the water. And they probably thought, I'm going under. That things cleared up and they began to go, okay, now you're going to see. And what happened was that he didn't just get them into the promised land, but he increased their faith along the way. That he could trust them, that he was totally trustworthy. And so we go through that process all the time, which brings me to the last part, and that is faith always ends with demonstrations of commitment and trust. That's the act part. Is it when God has captured your heart and you trust him, then you'll follow through and take commitments of trust. You'll step out into areas that may scare you. Let me give you this. My first time I can remember taking a real act, a step of faith, was in high school. As a senior in high school, I was placing all of my faith in other things, and God had been working on me for probably 6 months. Was experiencing a lot of anxiety, a lot of like, oh my gosh, you're shaking my idols, you know. And so I was, and it wasn't until I had a teacher and a pastor that both were kind of God was using in my life. And so I'd given my life to Christ. I said, okay, God, I give it all to you. I'm tired of this. I've been placing my things in the wrong thing. So I want to trust you, and I give my life to you. But I knew that the next thing, I read my Bible enough to know the next thing I needed to do was go be baptized. But I waited about 6 months. And there's a reason. It's because when I was a little kid and I was swimming in a hot springs, I always used to love to go under the water and swim underwater. And one day when I was swimming underwater, bubbles started to come out my ears. And the minute I surfaced, both my eardrums perforated. And it was just ringing and earache and horrible. And I remember screaming pain, and I just never experienced something so awful. And my mom got me to the doctor, and we went through all the ear stuff, and we're doing all that. And I remember him saying this statement, don't get your head submerged underwater anymore. Now, I associated the submersion of my head underwater with the pain that I experienced. So you better believe my head was never going to go underwater again. You can shower, you know, just be careful, you know, not to get a lot. So shower, that kind of a thing. But you just don't get your head submerged. So it hadn't. Since I was a little kid till senior year in high school, it hadn't. But then it came to the moment, though. Baptism involves, as far as I can understand it, you get lowered under the water. You can see where I'm going with this? It means head submerged. And so I'm like, I mean, this was like the fear was coming. It's like, I can't do this, you know. What if I go deaf, you know? And finally I came to the point where I just said, I want to be obedient. And if I go deaf, then I go deaf. And if that's what God has for me, then that's going to be okay, because I want to take a step of obedience and faith in this. And so we did it at a mountain lake. And, you know, I was nervous, and I remember the exact place where we were. My friends were there. They were not spiritual at all, so this was going to be a big testimony to them. And I'll never forget when he said, I baptize you in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. And he's going down. I'm thinking, those are the last words I'm hearing. And he goes down, and I don't know whether he thought I was extra bad, because he put me deep. And he took me deep, and he popped me up, and he said, congratulations, I heard him. And I was just like, I can hear. And I just got back, and I was so excited, I dove back in the water, you know, and I'm like, I'm rebaptizing myself, you know, a couple times. I was just so excited, I'm just splashing around, I'm getting my head underwater. I'm still careful with it, because it's still one of those things, but I was like, I can hear. And I could just, you know, I could just, the Lord will reward those who earnestly seek him. And it was, for me, just like you have a story, it was by faith Doug decided to get baptized, even though it may mean that he would never hear again, because he would rather be obedient to Christ than to have his hearing. That's what we're talking about. When your faith, when your soul gets enraptured with God, you will take steps that other people would say are crazy. That's why you can say it is by faith that the Father continued to pray for his son to come back to the Lord. By faith, the high school student, you know, refused the temptation to compromise in order that they may be faithful to God. By faith, he went on a mission trip despite his fears of flying. By faith, Larry increased his giving, knowing that God owned it all. Do we trust him? See, faith varies according to the perceived greatness and beauty of the object. When he look at you and go, man, you really love me, and I know it, because I can see the steps of faith that are going. Will he find faith on the earth? Let's take it home. Worship team, you can come on up. You know, as we go through this study, as we continue the By Faith series, we will now go into the different people and how their moment, their shining moment, really displays for us as we continue to take journeys of faith. And when Jesus was in that upper room, we're gonna take communion together this morning, and we're gonna pass it to you. So if I can have the ushers come forward and get the communion. When Jesus was in that upper room with his disciples in that Last Supper, he knew that they were dealing with pride and they were dealing with confusion and fear. And basically he's saying, I want you to trust me. I want you to put your gaze on me and what I am doing and what I can do for you, because what I'm about to do is truly going to set you free. It's going to change your life. And this morning, as these elements are passed to you, what it is they're double stacked, so you'll have the bread on the bottom and the juice on the top. So you can go ahead and start passing those. And so just grab one, pass it along, and you can take it when you're ready. But I want you to contemplate a moment before you do, just to go, Lord, is my life displaying faith? Is my gaze upon you, or has something else captured my heart? Take a moment, ask yourself that question, and before you partake. The bread obviously represents the body of Christ that's been broken for us, and the juice represents the blood of Christ that has been shed for us. It is God working in us. It is not us getting more of him. It's him getting more of us. Let's take the Lord's Supper together.